This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Chris Morrow and I worked together at Surfer Magazine more or less from 1997 to 2007. We spent years in the same office space bantering about. The fondest memories for me might be the editorial meetings we had in the mornings, oftentimes in Evan Slater's or Chris Morrow's office. I would attempt to sit quietly, and eventually they would ask for my opinion and just as quickly dismiss it, and rightly so, as I was fairly outspoken and perhaps a little bit ignorant, also a little further down the totem pole, so to speak. This will be the second time I've had Chris Morrow on the podcast, and the only guest who's been on more than once. Chris is opinionated, articulate, and draws from decades of surf industry experience growing up at Ground Zero in Laguna Beach, Orange County, California. And Chris is a good friend. The Boardroom Podcast with Chris Morrow. Let us begin. Chris Morrow, welcome to the Boardroom Podcast. It's good to see you, my friend. Good morning.
Bassy, always good. How are you, man?
I am doing well. There's been a lot going on in our world, especially sort of relative to you and I, because as everyone knows, Surfer Magazine closed its doors, and that institution, if you will, had held a really strong and vital part in not only our hearts and our lives, but in the hearts and lives of many, many surfers, especially of our generation. So tell me your just general thoughts on the closing of Surfer Magazine as an institution.
It's sad. I mean, look, it's, gosh, you and I spent a lot of time there, and it was part of our family, really, you know? So there's that work aspect of it that you kind of reflect on, and you're like, oh man, that's the end of a chapter. I have all mixed emotions, right? On the one hand, it's been like watching this cancer patient, you know, slowly decline over the years, you know, watching all the different buyouts and this and that. And I think I left in 2008, but then I went back there because the company I went and started, we sold to Surfer and that group. Right. So I got an extra 5 years with that group, and it kind of breathed some survival life into them for a little while, kept them afloat a little longer. But it was always an uphill struggle, you know? And so I left for good in 2015. And even then, I mean, the writing was somewhat on the wall. And it was funny because when the news kind of came out and everybody was doing their little Surfer Mag memories, and I have a decent collection at home, not a full one. But I was trying to pinpoint, like, okay, what was peak industry? And that 2007 big issue was a 374-page issue.
What was the cover of that one?
It was Dane Reynolds, and it was, like busting down the door, Dane Reynolds kind of thing.
Right.
And it's funny because I look back at that and I go, okay, well, if you were going to try to pinpoint the peak of the surf industry, it was 2007. And literally, I remember being on a boat trip the very next month down in Mexico. I was on the Pelagic with Richard Woolcott, Andy, Bruce, Troy Eckert, all that stuff. Volcom had just gone public a few months before.
And this is right before the crash.
This is still 2007, but if you remember, In 2007, there was a big shock in August, and it happened in the middle of that boat trip, where Volcom stock hit 50, and it dropped all the way down to like 30. It was just plummeting, right?
Were those guys looking at their stock ticker on the boat?
Oh, dude, like Eckert was coming out of this little office room and just sort of flashing signals to Wooly and just sort of like stress under their eye, you know, because I mean, if you added it up at that time, when it was up at 50 bucks, I mean, on paper, Wooly was worth like 300 million bucks.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so, you know, you're watching just stuff just go crazy. And I actually interviewed Troy Eckert on my podcast last year, and we talk about it. It was pretty hilarious. And he barely remembers it. He's just like, dude, that whole period was such a blur.
Yeah.
You know, it was like that instantly changed the culture of our company when we went public. He goes, overnight, we went from two, you know, accountants to 30.
Yeah.
And he just goes, like, overnight, just changed the complexion of the culture.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting because
like secrecy, like all of a sudden doors are locked and a lot more transparency, a lot more tiptoeing around everything, and not
well,
quite
it's
as
just,
like
it's just,
rambunctious as Volcom had once been.
It's just having to justify everything. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to justify every decision, and you know, those guys, their whole rise was just on gut instinct. We like this guy, we're gonna back this guy, and this and that, you know. And surf marketing, it's hard to justify any of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The entire tour, it's hard to justify, as we're seeing now.
So let me take you back to Surfer Magazine 2007. It's interesting to me that you peak, that you mark that as the like sort of the penultimate of the, like the apex of the surf industry. Cause there were some times in the 90s where pre big issue, but there were some fat ass issues, right? Weren't there some?
Yeah, there was. Yeah, I mean, we could go back in here. It's more. It was more 80s
yeah.
than 90s.
I mean,
the early 90s were like paper thin. They were right. like 90 page issue. There was like a 92 page issue.
Yeah, like when Dave Carson first got in.
Yeah,
they got pretty thin. But.
And then it got back up in the 90s to a decent number. But I mean, you know, the difference between 250 and 374. Is freaking massive,
yeah.
You know, and then not even the normal monthly issues were over three,
right.
You know, there are some thick ones. And so, you know, there was all these different things happening. The shoe market was blowing up. The girls thing was blowing up. I mean, you had all these little.
Well, broadband was blowing up too. Like,
I mean,
in many ways, there was still a lot of, I guess at this time, stabilized tech money kind of floating around maybe.
Right. And it was, you know, the big thing with tech and the internet was, you know, early on the mags could somewhat compete against it just because video, it took a long time for video to arrive on the web to where it is today. It's hard to look back because it seems like 50 years ago now. It's all gone pretty fast,
yeah.
You know, but it took a long time for video to get where it is, you know, and it's yeah. like, and you know, you even look at Instagram over the last few years. Remember when it was like, you could only throw 15 seconds of video on there.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden you could throw your freaking movie in there, you know.
Let me bring you back to Surfer Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
When were you the editor in chief? What were those years?
04 to 08.
And then before then, give us some insight as to what you did there. I mean, I know, but the listeners.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, when I came in, I was just so Steve Hawk, I was freelancing for them a lot during the 90s. I was living up north, and every once in a while Hawk would call and just be like, hey, do you want to go do this thing? And we'll send you here, and be like, sure. And then, when a position opened in 98, Hawk was like, hey, I'm getting ready to leave. We need somebody to come in. You know, Evan's already here. We want you to come in and work with Evan. Are you good? And it was like, awesome. So that's when I joined. That was in 98. That was the summer of 98. And that was really fun. And then there was this whole, but really quickly in 2000, there was this dot-com exodus where the dot-coms were offering everybody in the magazines triple their salary. Just be like, come join.
Yeah.
And so there was this sort of mass exodus. And Evan and Steve and those guys all went one direction. I actually went another. I was fortunate in that the direction I went, I got to keep my Surfer Magazine ties. Like I was still working for them.
Right.
And, you know, within a year or so, most of those things imploded. It was the cocktail napkin height of the web, just crazy. If it says .com, it'll fund, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other story.
Well, but, I'm interested in that a little bit.
I think we talked about it in our last one, didn't we?
We probably did.
But yeah, it was,
Both of us don't remember.
I went to work for a company. It's probably more relevant now.
Here's my question to you.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think that if Surfer Magazine had pivoted with an online proposition to the surfers that wasn't available in the print, that the magazine would still be in business, and not necessarily the magazine, but the brand Surfer would still be in business if they had pivoted to an online proposition which wasn't available in the print? In other words,
Look,
I'll let you answer that question. I don't know if you know where I'm going with this, but
I don't know if you were there. What year did you leave?
07.
07, okay. So then you were probably there during that period where we were considering trying to come up with the go head-to-head against Surfline.
I was there, and it drove me friggin' crazy.
Yeah, and we actually wanted to join Surfer and Surfing because Prime Media bought us.
Right.
And we're like, hey, let's have a forecast site and put Surfer and Surfing kind of together in this little wheelhouse, right? And that was because Surfline was the big threat at the time. They were getting into content.
Absolutely.
And they had the utility. And so they were making a big push there. And had we done that, I absolutely think it would have been very competitive and it would have given us a pretty big boost. And you know, the properties may exist, but look, if you look at media as a whole, they've all been hit. You know, I mean, look at ESPN, look at all these things across the board. The digital, you know, takeover of this thing has taken out so much profit margin and cut out so much of the fat in all these areas where, you know, if you're a newspaper, if you're anybody in publishing, it's really, really tough right now. So, and it doesn't help. Surfer's biggest problem was the fact that they were always part of a giant group.
Yeah.
And they were the flagship, and the people who own it would never want to separate it and sell it off on its own, because then the rest of their thing has less value.
So what I'm getting from you is that if we would have pivoted to a Waves, a cam network and a forecasting network on Surfer Magazine's website, the brand would probably still be healthy because we could have made a transition and actually competed against Surfline.
Yeah, I mean, like the, I don't know if you remember those cameras that we had, but it was like kind of cool. You could control the camera, pan it left or right and look at the surf, and those things were killer. Like they're great. And you know, but it was an expensive proposition.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because frankly, I'm thinking right now,
It's
not expensive. It's very inexpensive to set up a cam network and a forecasting site. Relative to 2004.
Yeah. Oh, way cheaper now.
There's turnkey solutions out there.
Yeah.
You could just buy a SimpliSafe program and just put it up on.
It is. You know, it is for sure. I think, you know, the Surfline juggernaut in that area, though, when you look at how many cams they have. They have such a commanding lead in the cam department.
Yeah,
and granted, it's expensive and whatever. But, you know, if you look, Surfline's sort of, in my opinion, they've backed off the content push.
Yeah.
You know, they've definitely cut their stuff. And they're just like, hey, we're a utility. And there's a big difference between a utility and a publishing company, you know. So, you know, it's so sad.
If we would have pivoted, you're saying maybe if – we didn't
I would say there was a better chance they'd still be alive for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Surfer Magazine.
Bass, it's always alive in our hearts. It's Surfer's never going away.
I obviously am still frustrated that we didn't get cams and forecasts on the free.
Oh no. You and I were on the same side of that argument. And it was a frustrating.
Don Meek came in and said, "We're gonna do it, but it's not gonna be on Surfer's website. It's gonna be a standalone." I was like, my God.
Yeah.
Anyway, here's my next question to you regarding Surfer Magazine.
Okay.
Should Surfer Magazine or any content in the surf space be political?
You mean take a political side and basically what sort of like what they did where they said we're endorsing this candidate kind of thing?
I'm just saying.
I think they're
impossible to be apolitical.
I would say no. I think, look, it's, but to me, I think it's, I think it's way better to be apolitical as much as possible, but just have as many voices as you can on either side of issues, you know? And I think you got to be able to present both sides. And I'm frankly, I think you're super uninteresting when you're just peddling one agenda. I think you become super uninteresting. And, you know, nowadays more than ever, it's so important, I feel like, to find those people on both sides of the aisle who are talking civilly to each other, and they're figuring out amongst themselves where they agree. And they talk through the issues. They don't, it's not this standoff like, oh my God, you think that way? I cannot talk to you. That's fucked. Yeah. And if you're on that, if you're one of those people, you're fucked, because you're a big part of the problem, in my opinion. Right. And that's what's leading us to where we are. And that's what social media has sort of driven us to. I think if you are opposed to sitting down with somebody and really exploring, you know, well, and half the time, you know, when you do that, you find out, gosh, we agree on 95% of stuff. You know what I mean? Yeah. Where we disagree is what is the best solution.
Right.
Right? That's it. And that's where all the fucking battle happens. You know what I mean? And so to me, it's a tragedy when what's happening in the media today is just the whole institution of media is just being lit on fire. So, you know, I think what you're seeing, and this just goes for, you know, goes across the board, it's WSL, it's this, that. Institutions across the spectrum are being blown up as we speak, yeah. You know? And so people are naturally kind of concerned and fearful for like, well, gosh, what does this mean? You know, like, is this wall that I'm trying to climb the right wall? It does it make sense? Or where do I go from here? What does the future look like? And they're naturally concerned, and it's hard, you know, it's hard to figure out where the good information is nowadays.
Let me ask you this. I'm going to bring it back to Surfer Magazine.
Sure.
What was your favorite all-time issue?
My favorite that I enjoyed working on the most was the 45th anniversary, which was the one who had, it had Skip Fry on the cover.
Yeah.
That one was great because it was really a chance to kind of go through each era of surfing,
yeah.
Break it up into sort of little chapters and weed out these. It was sort of a legends and lore vibe.
Yeah.
And that one, I think we had so much fun producing. Parmer was a huge help on that one. And we had a bunch of other people, you know, from different eras chiming in, and it was great. I mean, I got a letter from Severson after that issue just saying, hey, that was my favorite issue.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, and I was really proud of that, because like to have that, you know, that was the only time I heard from John Severson, you know, from in any kind of letter the entire time I was there.
Yeah.
So he was just like, hey, this thing was killer. And that was great.
I remember he walked through the halls one time. Were you there for that?
Yeah, that was cool. That, I can't remember what he was there for. Do you?
Something like some licensing of
some
business thing, and he was working with Norbon.
Right. I don't know. Trying to, maybe it was getting all his films or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Look, Sean Doherty recently bought Surfing World magazine.
Yep.
It died on the vine, in some regards, very similar to what happened to Surfer.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to recreate Surfing World magazine, which is much beloved in Australia, in much the same vein as Surfer magazine here in North America.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be a labor of love for Sean. Is this something, do you think that an entity, like an individual or whatever, a couple of guys, could approach American Media, which owns Surfer magazine, and go, hey, look, this thing's dead on the vine. You're not doing anything with it. I think what they're probably doing, Chris, and you might have some insight, is they're probably still milking a few pennies here and there via licensing, like Surfer the Bar and Surfer T-shirts or whatever it is they're licensing. I don't know, toothbrushes. Who knows? You think you could go, not you, but somebody, go to American Media and go, hey, look, here's a number. Give me Surfer Magazine. This is an institution that needs to carry on.
Honestly, I don't know. I mean, I think I've heard that they've been approached that way. I know for years, Tony Perez was trying to do that. Mm. And then, you know, he had supposedly grabbed some other people, but the answer was always no. I don't know. I would probably, you know, my only thing is like, is that really, if you, whoever was behind that, I would say, is that really where you want to put your money? You know, because
I'm just suggesting to you, it's almost more of like Sean Doherty's thing where it's like labor of love type of thing. Like,
right.
You know, Andrew Kidman's got,
but I don't think Sean had to plop down a pretty penny to go get it.
Yeah. I don't know.
You know what I mean? I think he picked it up for pennies on the dollar. Whereas American media is probably not going to let Surfer go for, you know, there's some brand equity in there, you know, on the name. And so I think that's a different beast. Yes. I think what's more important is, you know, there's all these different writers and.
So Kidman put out this new magazine. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen
it yet.
I heard about it.
Yeah. I just bought 2 issues and they're being sent to me. I want to take a peek at it.
That's cool.
But I'm just, more than anything, I want to support him.
Yeah.
And I'm asking you, how crucial is it to our culture to have some sort of ideological guiding light? You know, right now we've got Instagram, we've got all this stuff and it's just a mishmash and there's nowhere really where you can kind of pin your ideal and go, this is what Severson meant, or this is where we should go, or we can all agree on these three values. Let's move forward with those as our sort of guiding pinnacle. Like, do we need that? Does the culture need something like that? Or is it better that we're just like mishmash?
Yeah. But you're this lost soul looking for your church right now. That's what you're doing, right?
You are my church.
It's like,
you are my preacher.
It's I get it. I think everybody sort of feels that way. And
do we need it? Do we need it? Can we just survive?
I think,
are we even a culture if we don't have it?
I think our culture has definitely been watered down, right? Like surf culture has been absolutely watered down. And people ask me like, well, what's going on? And I'm like, well, you know, imagine we were this gritty neighborhood when we were growing up and then we got crazy gentrified and then the bubble burst, right? And so now all these mom and pops or all these sort of characters that were there when it was gritty, you know, have gone away and these big corporations are just hollowed out. That's what's left. That to me is the landscape of this quote. That's just the industry,
right?
The lineup hasn't changed. There's more people in the water, obviously, than ever before.
Right.
But, you know.
But do those people need a community center to go to?
Well,
to continue your metaphor.
It would be nice. I think this, and frankly, it's not just the media that's responsible for all this. It's surf shop culture and all that kind of stuff, right? Like we were steeped in that when we were kids and Groms and just respect for the shapers and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of that stuff is still, I think a lot of that is there. You might have to look a little harder for it. But there's certainly pockets where it's there. Every community has their sort of tribal elder leader crew shop, this, that, and the other. They're maybe not as much of a hangout as they used to be. That's the thing I miss because, you know, you and I probably grew up running around with our friends outside and you'd either meet at the beach or some park or some shop and you had these little hangout centers and shops were a huge hangout center.
Yeah.
I don't know how many of them are that way today.
Yeah.
You know, but that's what needs to happen to bring the community together. A community, people go, oh, well, we're this online community. I'm like, online communities are bullshit. It's, you know, community is face-to-face, rubbing elbows, being with these people, human eye contact. That's community. And that's the kind of stuff that fills your soul up when you're seeing it. You know, it's like, whereas when you're trying to get more likes on your little page, that's just draining.
So my question, though, was, does the culture require it? Does it need to have something that guides it? And or are all of these little Instagram feeds, does Jonathan Wayne Freeman, does Kook of the Week, does Ryan Birch's feed, do all of these great feeds sort of
equal a tapestry
equal,
of,
one?
Yeah. I mean,
And is that good enough?
I mean, we're all self-curating our own magazines now. We all follow who we want to follow, and we don't follow who we don't want to follow, right? So in essence, you're getting a custom magazine in your phone every day.
That's a good point.
And so,
not really in depth, but great point.
No, it's just one of these things where I think you're missing is the long-form piece of content, deep investigative kind of like story narrative-driven stuff where it's a deep profile, and that's where, you know, because everything's just so quick hit, surface level, nothing's really deep.
Who does the best Instagram feed, do you think? Or one of the good ones? Not the best, I'm not going to say best, but who do you like enjoy, or you feel like you get something a little bit more than, hey, check out my wave yesterday at Salt Creek?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. I mean, I always like the guys like MR and that, who actually, who write write exactly. a little bit more and give yeah. you some context and history. And
I think his is great. That yeah. The one I was actually thinking.
And I mean, I have my own little People Who Surf one that's got like 2,000 followers. And that's kind of what I try to do is just write more stories.
Yeah.
You know, because like you could fit 2,200 characters on an Instagram story or on an Instagram post.
Yeah.
And that's about 300 words. Yeah. And you could tell a decent story in 300 words. It's hard,
yeah.
but you could do it.
Yeah.
And so it's not, and that's not how you get Instagram followers. It's not something where they reward you for that. They want you to put video and all that kind of stuff. But if you train your own sort of audience that, hey, this is what I'm offering you, you could build a little base. And so it's fun. But yeah, what I miss is right now what the world misses from the magazine thing, I think. And you could get this online a little bit here and there, but they're just not doing it as much as, you know, when we did profile stories or big features, they were 3,000-4,000 words, yeah. sometimes five. Yeah. And that's a lengthy story and it can get, you can get pretty in depth. And so there are a lot of issues that just aren't being covered.
Yeah.
By, you know, we think we're in touch with the world. That's the funniest thing. I hear young kids go, well, gosh, I have access to more information than you ever did. I know way more than you. I'm like, no, you don't. Like, I'm just like, you have zero context, like zero context. And that's the problem, right? I think that's the problem with today's generation.
Wow. Get off my lawn, Chris.
I just mean, I don't mean it like it's, I just saw that as like this post and I'm just like, really? Like, you really think you have context for that stuff? And I think that's where I just laugh, you know? So, that's the biggest hole in media today is context.
What about, a few minutes ago, we were discussing politics and the surf media specifically. And there were some people that were suggesting maybe Todd Perdonovich, who was the editor at Surfer at the end there, was too political.
Mm.
And some were saying, you know what, they should only just cover, you know, Stoke and Killer Eye Candy and, you know, maybe some in-depth mm-hmm. profiles, but leave the politics out of it. I mean, mm-hmm. there's enough politics everywhere else in the world, and I think there's some truth to that.
Right.
But when I look back and I think of, like, for instance, the 2005 Clark Foam closing.
Mm-hmm.
That was had some political context, don't you think?
Not really.
What about the Trestles Toll Road?
Little bit, but yeah.
What about, say, dodging the draft during the Vietnam War era and the Severson era?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you can't separate yourself exactly. from it. But I think the key there is, though, each of those things you mentioned, right? Especially the Toll Road and even Clark Foam. I think it's really important to cover both sides, right? Yeah. Like, why did Grubby shut down?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? What was the reasons why? What was going on? What does that pretend? Was he foreshadowing what was going to happen in California and keep going to happen in California? And if you look fast forward, look at how many businesses are leaving. You know, you could certainly make the case, you know, that he was just saying, hey guys, you know, and some people might be happy about that. And be like, well, fuck it. And some people might not be. But I think it's your responsibility to cover both sides. And I remember even during the Toll Road debate, you know, the gut impulse is like, save Trestles, save Trestles, save Trestles. It's like, okay, well, let me ask you something, Scott. Did you read Surfrider's environmental impact study on the Toll Road?
No, but I have a bumper sticker.
Okay. Well, you know why you didn't read it? Because they didn't do one. Surfrider never did an environmental impact study on that whole thing.
It's not their job to do that.
I know. But you know, here's the thing that most people don't know is that, and I'm no fan of the freaking Toll Road or their agency, but those guys, at least they went to the Surfrider and they found the guy who was their one of their environmental guys who did the study, Dave Skinner. You know him. He's down in your neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I looked at his thing and I looked at his slides and I read his whole study. And I just, when I looked at this thing, I'm like, okay, I get it. You know, but nobody was talking that side. And what I was actually, I'm like, I went to the TCA and I went into the office there to get their comments from them. And I'm like, hey, so I'm looking at this scale model of the bridge and everything. I'm like, how high is that thing? And they're like, oh, well, it's 60 feet. And I'm all, well, could you make it lower? And they're like, well, yeah, we could totally make it lower. And I'm like, wait, don't talk to me. I'm like, who are you talking to at Surfrider about this? And they're like, oh, they don't talk to us. Yeah. Like, they won't even say a thing. I'm like, really? Yeah. I go, so if this thing goes through, they're not going to have any input?
Yeah.
You know, and that troubled me. As an editor and somebody who tries to cover both sides, the fact that neither side was talking to each other,
yeah,
that was an issue for me, because had it gone the other way,
yeah,
we, you know, they would have just been, and so those things, you know, there's always more to the story there. And I'm a much moreist. I'm not a one side or the other. I think there's 18 million different angles of it. And that's one of the things I've learned. And so it's just like, you know, we were, I'm anti-toll road because I just think toll roads as a whole, like as a taxpayer, I think it's bullshit. Yeah. That's what our taxes pay for. Why is this a toll road?
Yeah.
And I'm very much a conservationist and want everything to be preserved as much as possible.
Yeah.
But I just think, you know, a lot of times we use scare tactics and this and that. And, you know, we can be for our own agenda. And then it can sometimes backfire. And so you just have to be careful.
Hey, if you're interested in becoming a sponsor of the Boardroom Podcast, we would, of course, love to hear from you. Send us an email, info@surfboardshow.com, an effective and authentic way to get your message across to the masses. Send us an email, info@surfboardshow.com.
You know, Sam George has often argued that surfers as a whole, as a culture,
mm-hmm,
are really conservative.
Mm.
That everything has to sort of be fit into a box of what's acceptable. And if it doesn't fit into our box, we can be extremely dismissive and spiteful.
Hmm.
An example of this, for instance, is stand-up paddleboarding, battery-operated surfboards, foiling, stand-up foiling. Maybe the Molokai crossing, kite foiling, new and exciting things that are happening in the surf world that, as an editor of Surfer Magazine, we might have said, well, that's not really what our advertisers want us to publish.
Mm-hmm.
You think that we're conservative to a fault?
I think for sure the magazines tend to, you know, be reductionist. In the sense that I think that was one of the big things that I think is the biggest problem with pro surfing right now, is it's become super reductionist, right? Surfing has expanded out into all these things you just mentioned, all these crazy ways to ride waves. And some of the best surfers in the world are foiling.
Absolutely.
And they're doing all these crazy things. I mean, Kai Lenny to me is one of the most fascinating characters there is in the sport. Period, hands down. He could ride anything, and he does. And you know, I don't remember seeing a lot of mag features on him. No. You know what I mean? I really don't.
Yeah.
And had I been editor, I would have been all. I frankly would have been all over that.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I was. I've always, like, even the surfboard when I was there, I was very into kind of pushing the alternative surf craft thing and all that kind of stuff. And you know, the stand up thing hadn't really hit then. You know, I remember making fun of Laird when he, you know, paddled out of Malibu with his American flag, and I think that was right when it started.
You're
like
making fun of me.
Yeah, but you and I did some stuff together, and we rode. I rode stand up paddles for a while, and and I like it. It's not something I, but
are we conservative?
Well, I think it's like, we know what our audience wants from us, right?
Yeah.
We know what they're coming to look for, and we have limited page space.
Yeah.
It's a whole different deal when you, I guess when you have unlimited space online. And you could just be like, okay, cool. Here's our little tab with stand-up paddlers.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy to just add that.
Yeah.
If you want to, and categorize people, but
is it outside the brand if you do that? Like, did we get to such a place that we limited our scope? So then to now add some of these outside the box things,
well,
people, the listeners, the readers might just go, oh, well, that's not who you are. Why are you doing that?
Yeah. I think there was concern every time something new came along, like, well, shit, how do we treat this? You know, how inclusive do we get? And, you know, I think, you can go back to the Hawk era. I think they did a big giant profile on Mike Stewart and he copped so much shit for it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And Mike Stewart's one of the most incredible watermen in the world.
Absolutely.
So, you know, surfers are.
That speaks to how lame we are.
That's just our culture. It's like, hey, just show me riding wave. Like, show me the guys standing on boards. And so, yeah.
Surfers
yeah,
are the worst,
yeah. We're pricks. Yeah. Yeah. And to answer your question, I would say, yeah, we don't like change. Surfers don't like change.
What was your worst memory or experience at Surfer Magazine?
I don't know. I mean, none of them were, all of my problems there were self-induced, just me being me, you know, like, you know, you and I were in these creative space and there were so many times we just like be locker room, just shut the fuck up.
Did you ever get one of those?
But you know, Sam and I, it's funny because Sam and I are like, even now, like I consider Sam a really good friend, yeah. But we hated working for each other. Yeah. Like, and I worked under him. And I mean, it was so infuriating because he would just take off to like Easter Island to go chase McCohey down or something for whatever. And like, we're like,
on a romantic yes. So,
and without telling anybody, we're like in the middle of deadline. And then it's like, and then he'll come back and complain about what happened while he was gone. It's like, well, dude. You know, it's like, so that was super frustrating. I'm not going to lie.
That's so funny.
Sam and like, I was trying to get Sam fired and he was trying to get me fired for half the time, like during different periods, you know, not like, I mean, but it was like, but then it would be outside the office and it's just like, it's great. But it was just that work environment was kind of like, oh God, we were total polar opposites on how we approached it.
You know, it was probably the most memorable and funny moment for me at Surfer Magazine.
What's that?
Is when Ruth, our secretary, our assistant, administrative assistant,
yeah,
would get on the microphone and you would hear, Ricky Irons, Eddie Rothman's on the phone. Ricky Irons, Eddie Rothman's on the phone. And she'd say it through the whole office and everyone would just go, oh no. And you'd see Rick just like put his head down and just walk into his office.
Yeah. You know, and I fielded a few of those.
I bet you did.
And, that's never fun. You know, it's never fun. But, you know, it's like I felt like I stood my ground. Yeah, he was
reasonable. Actually.
He was very reasonable and he was really forthcoming with me.
Question, you know?
At one point he wanted me to help him with his book. And but then what happened was the Hot 100 came out one year and Makua it came out in third. And Eddie was really not happy, and I got like just some gnarly message on my voicemail, just that was that.
Right. What about do you like? Somebody brought up an interest. I think Chuck Elliott brought up something to me the other day that I had forgotten about. But when we were at the Surfer House one year, on the North Shore, we got a house every year for the listeners that don't know, just like all the companies. There was this crazed guy on crystal meth on ice that was robbed, that robbed us.
Oh yeah.
Were you at the house for that?
Yeah. He was robbing all the houses. He robbed the neighbors too. Yeah. That was gnarly.
That was pretty heavy.
Yeah. That was super heavy.
Was it you or were you there when it happened? Cause somebody, I think it might've been,
I don't think
Grant,
I was,
or somebody chased him down.
Yeah, no, I don't think I was there, but I saw the guy, he had appeared a couple times and he was kind of wandering around the neighborhood and I don't know if it was our neighbors who ended up catching the guy or what, but he was creepy looking. And you know those people who are methed out like that, that look in their eyes?
Yeah.
I just remember my vivid memory, and I can't remember at all what happened, was him yelling at somebody. And I don't know if Brewer was freaking giving him a dress down or somebody was, but he just looked crazed. And like those people are – like when you get that scene, it's gnarly.
Yeah.
But that's – I mean, that's not rare.
No.
You know what I mean? Like that kind of stuff that was not an anomaly.
What's your number one memory? I mean, do you like, maybe you don't have one, you know,
you mean positive memory?
Just in general, you know, and I don't mean like a vague overall, like I had a good time there. I
yeah.
mean like, do you remember getting spit out of the tube in Indo? Like what? I don't know. You know, like,
is there
a moment where you're like,
I was on the September Sessions trip, so I got a lot of barrels on that trip. And then, you know, even when I was a freelancer and stuff, like Hawk sent me to J-Bay. Well, actually, he didn't send me to J-Bay. He sent me to Cape Town to go do some big wave stuff with Brock and Noah Johnson. They wanted to go explore these reefs. And so, but the storms kept hitting. So we just kept driving up to J-Bay and scoring J-Bay. And that was one of the, to this day, one of the best trips of my life, because I ended up staying down there for like 2 months.
Yeah.
And, as far as like, you know, the it's hard because you and I both were right there during those fat years. Mm-hmm. Like we were there during the, and you and I could pretty much take off whenever we wanted to go do something. And we took full advantage of it. Yeah, and I was talking to some guys last week, Jay Larson and these guys, and I'm like, you know, in a way, Surfer Magazine was basically me being able to have my pro career after my pro career and do it the way I wanted to. Because when I was on tour, it was all shit waves. It was the parking lot tour. It was exactly what you and Barton were talking about during that interview you did with Barton last week. And it was like the worst spots in the world. There was no good waves on the tour. And you're there with 200 other guys. And it was just, it was not what you signed up for when you were a Grom. That's not what the dream was when I was a kid. Like yeah. if they would have marketed that, that's not what I would have been going to. Surfer was cool because it was like, hey, for the better part of 10 years, I got to go travel around and do shit on my own terms. That's yeah. a fun way to see the world.
No, I agree.
You know what I mean? So it's hard for me to pick.
I specifically remember I would be like, yeah, I'm going to Indo. And you're like, you're going to Indo again on a boat trip with your friends? For what reason exactly? And I'm like, editorial.
Yeah, totally. You milked it and you did a great job of it, and more power to you. Yeah. And it was, I just laughed because I'm like, who are you taking with you, Bassie? You
know, it's like some friends.
Yeah, at least I had like Slater and Dorian and those guys, you know what I mean? But
I would
like,
grab some C-listers.
But yeah. Try. Yeah. But it, you know, that was. That was cool. And then we did some, that was a great opportunity for us to go do it. And you know, the magazines had money then. We had budgets. We could do a lot of cool stuff. And, you know, and then you mix in the surfer poles and all that. Like the surfer pole to me, when it was in Irvine, was a great little celebration of surf culture.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that evening. I enjoyed putting that thing on. I enjoyed that process of going through all the videos and everything like that and really doing that. And I think that's something that I think the culture is going to miss more than anything is that evening where everybody gets together once a year and they celebrate the accomplishments of what has gone on in this space, because there's a lot cool stuff going on.
Yeah. That's a really good, some good insight there. You know, the surfer pole's no longer.
It's no longer.
That's pretty weird.
Yeah. It's no longer. Yeah. And it was a very big deal, you know? And so
it had lost some of its cachet along with the print space in general.
I think a lot of that had to do, like, I wasn't, no offense, but I wasn't stoked when they moved it to Hawaii.
Yeah.
I wasn't there. That was after I left, but I thought that was, I just didn't like that move. I know it's a cool little deal because everybody's on the North Shore. The problem is when you're in Hawaii, everybody sort of behaves differently.
Yeah.
They don't cut loose because they're afraid.
Yeah.
There's just sort of this thing where it's like, you got to watch yourself.
Yeah.
And, you know, it got pretty crazy up in Irvine. Those parties got a little out of hand, but that's what surf culture is. It's supposed to get that way.
Yeah.
And the guys who didn't want to get crazy, they would sneak out early and do their thing. And the guys who did would stay. And that was cool.
Yeah.
It was okay. Do you remember those postmortems we used to do after the surfer pole? It's just like, okay.
Yeah.
Where is everybody? You know? And how did it go? It's like, well, there was a guy climbing the pole naked and we need to, you know, talk to the cops about whatever. It's like, like there was stuff that, you know, was fun to kind of revisit, but that you know, that was a great time.
One of the irons.
But you know, they had some of those better moments, like, you know, when Mick Fanning got up there. That 1 year Slater won, and Mick interrupted Kelly's speech, and Mick was Eugene. He was being Eugene.
Oh, God.
Remember that?
Vaguely, yeah.
And well, Kelly's like, dude, you're interrupting my speech. He's like, what would happen if I did this down in Australia? And Mick's like, you get lied. And I just think those little memories are pretty classic when you think back on them now, like that little window. Because at the time, it's just like that didn't feel like it was going to end. You know, you just thought that was going to be cool. But as most things, it changes.
And there were so many great people that we worked with that were behind the scenes that
really held it together, you know, like Tony Casimiro.
Yeah, Casey Kelly. It's just like Laura Lynn back in the day. And
Canham, Jeff Canham.
Jeff Canham, yeah, exactly.
Bunch of good people, too, you know. Whatever. I mean, that's going to make for some boring podcasts. But
No, it's that's the family aspect you're talking about. Yeah. And it is. It was a big family there for a long time. And, you know, the people who worked there, you know, they had
Randy Ward.
Randy, of course, you know. Legend. Yeah. So, yeah, it's kind of like, in a way, it's like being at a private school or something. You know, those are friends for the rest of your life.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. You know? It's kind of like a private school.
Yeah.
Let's shift gears a little bit.
Sure.
You are an ambassador for the 100 Wave Challenge. It's a fundraiser for the Boys to Men Mentoring Program.
Yeah. Thanks to you.
Well, you've been doing some great things. And so I want to hear kind of where we're at with the 100 Wave Challenge this year. And And John Florence, I mean, he's a part of it. This is great.
Yeah, that was really huge. I'm super stoked on that. You know, I was so blown away when so your boardroom show, I think it was in 2019. So it was last year. You asked me to host a couple panels and you know, one of them was like Wayne Lynch, and I was super psyched. And you're like, yeah, then there's this Boys to Men thing. I'm all, okay, cool. What is it? And you told me what it was. And I immediately, it was kind of funny because here I am. I'm a guy who's in surf media my whole life, and this thing's been running. That was their 10th anniversary they were warming up for the 100 Wave Challenge down in San Diego. And I felt really bad because I'm like, I've never even heard of this thing, you know? And that's how little sort of PR outside the San Diego bubble they had been getting. None of the surf press had ever really given them any love, anything like that. And so when I met Joe, I did a little prep before we went and did the panel, I called him.
Joe
and just,
Sigurdsson, he's one of the directors.
Yeah, he's one of the co-founders. And we connected and he told me what they were all about. And then he introduced me to some of the kids before we went on. And then we did the panel at the boardroom show. And I immediately was just like, this is so cool. I got to do the 100 Wave Challenge this year. And you've done it several years, so you know. So I went down and I was just like, this is an amazing cause because these guys – and the story is amazing because here it is. The surfing community in San Diego has really been the backbone of this 501c3. They are the primary, you know, funders of this thing. And it's just because Joe had some surf, a little bit of surf in him, you know, and, but the cause is so great because he's literally taking these, a lot of, sort of at-risk kids, inner city, a lot of them have nothing to do with surfing at all. You know, they're like in Lemon Grove and in San Diego. Yeah. But you know, these kids are one decision away from like life altering, you know, joining gangs and staying in gangs or whatever. And they just have, a lot of them are fatherless. The vast majority are fatherless. Yeah. And even if they do have a male sort of mentor, he's not necessarily the most productive. It might be a gangbanger.
Right.
And so they take these kids, these at-risk kids, and their organization, the history behind them and how they sort of formed, it took them a while to kind of find their wheelhouse and what was really working. But the way they work today is they've connected with a bunch of junior highs and some high schools in San Diego County. And the administrators, when they open a new school, they will go, hey, here are five or six most at-risk kids that need help right now. And it's mandated. These kids are mandated to go attend these Boys to Men meetings once a week. Yeah. With these mentors. And so they'll go and there'll be like three or four men and a bunch of these kids who are all kind of in the same boat. And it's just a group mentoring thing where these kids are listened to and they're given a lot of love and support by these guys who've been through it. And they don't tell them what to do. They never tell them what to do. They just say, hey, this is what happened to me. And let me tell you, when I kind of made this decision, what the results were, you know, and then they ask them what they think they should do and what they think, you know, steps they want to take. And so there's this whole accountability thing. And they really establish a very real relationship with these guys. And, you know, one of the kids who I interviewed, both at your boardroom show and later on my podcast, was a kid named Joe Ross who was in the program when he was 12 years old. And, you know, he talks about this story. He's like, look, I had nobody and I didn't go into Boys to Men willingly. He goes, but after a few weeks, I realized like these guys aren't, they're for real. He goes, and what happened was my mom one day collapsed. She was having some kind of seizure or something. And he and his brother had no idea what to do. They called 911. He had nobody to call. And so he called Joe. And Joe went to the hospital and stayed with them all night, you know, and so did one of the other mentors. Like, and he was just like, that's when it hit me. Like, these are my guys. These are the men. There are good men out there. Yeah. You know, there's good men out there who care and do stuff. And so, and you look at the results, like these kids who go through this program, the first 6 weeks it's mandated. After that, it's all voluntary, whether they want to stay in or not. And the vast majority of them do. Yeah. Because they're getting something out of it and they're getting something positive. And then not only that, they're asked to basically bring in some of their friends, yeah. You know, who are maybe having the same issues or struggling. And so when they start out maybe with six kids at the beginning of the year, they may end up with 15 or 20 at a specific school by the end of the year who are coming through. And so they've got chapters now, you know, they're 20 years old. They kind of been in that school thing for a good 10. And that's when they, because before that they were doing these sort of weekend retreats and all these other little things. And, Yeah. And it was just trying to figure out what was the most efficient way to pull it off. But it's great. And they're not, the other advantage they have is they're partnered with schools, but they're not the schools. So they have a lot more latitude on what they can say and do and, you know, how they can interact with these kids because they're not part of the school. Yeah. At the end of the day, they're saving lives. Like every dime that gets raised goes to facilitating these mentors. So there's training of the mentors. Like if you're a mentor, you have to go through all the background checks and then they train you because it's like, hey, you're not here to tell these kids what to do. It's all this empathy stuff and everything else. And then they're facilitating all the meetings. They're actually tracking the kids and their progress, how much attendance, Yeah. If their attitude's changing and then their grades and everything like that. And it was funny because I went down to watch Josh Kerr and Damian Hobgood do their 100 wave the other day, and Joe was up there.
So real quick, the 100 wave, you go out, you catch 100 waves, and you raise money for how much money per wave? Like, say, give me $1 a wave. I'm going to catch 100 waves.
Yeah, you can do it. It's kind of a jogathon model in a way, if you can. Or you just say, hey, I'm going to be doing this for this cause. Here's my donation link. You know, I'd love your support. Right. Some people break it into waves. Some people don't.
So Josh and Damian.
But Josh and Damian. Damian's been doing it for a number of years. He's been a huge supporter. And then Josh just kind of stepped up this year, which is huge, you know.
Sean Thompson's been doing it for a number of
years. Sean Thompson's been doing it from the get-go, and he's
Jesse
like...
Jesse Fan does it.
Does he? Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah, that's rad. So it's one of these things where those guys were down at Cardiff. They were doing it... Carlsbad at the state park kind of near Kersey's house. Mm-hmm. And Joe was up there just serving coffee and stuff to people who were kind of coming by, and we were sitting there, and the ranger lady came by, and he was right outside the little shop right there, kind of giving away a lot of stuff that they sell inside. And so we're like, oh shit, is he getting busted? And this lady comes up, she's like, Joe, do you remember me? And he's like, Liz? And it was like this cool little reunion, you know, this ranger lady. And they talked for a little bit, and then she comes to me, and he told her what we were up to and who was out there. And she looked at me, and she kind of was like, he told her what I was doing. And she goes, let me tell you something. She goes, this guy saved my son's life. He's 22 now. He went in the program when he was 14. We had just moved with my husband and I, ugly divorce. Yeah. And, you know, moved to a new city, and we could only afford this little apartment. My son didn't have any friends at his new school, and he was just really struggling, Yeah. You know, and she just said, I'd be completely screwed without these guys. Yeah. And that's the thing. It's a lot of these single moms who are out there, Yep. You know, trying to just keep their kids on track. It's really, really tough. Yeah. And so it's a godsend to them. And unfortunately, the fatherless situation is an epidemic in our culture right now. Mm-hmm. It's a problem that's not going to go away. And so there's a very huge need for this whole thing. And, you know, fortunately, it's like Hawaii is the second biggest chapter outside of San Diego. There's chapters everywhere. There's about 14 or 15 across the U.S. Yep. But Hawaii has the second biggest. Cool. And so it was really cool to see, you know, John kind of step up and put his name behind it because, you know, he's somebody who's fairly familiar with it, you know.
Yeah.
And his team of guys, they understand it. So Brandon Wasserman, who's John's one of his managers, he kind of told me, he goes, you know, my mom worked in child protective services for 25 years. She just retired. She knows all about Boys to Men. She loves them.
Cool.
You know what I mean?
How great is that?
Which is freaking awesome.
Yeah.
And then Petey Johnson is another guy who's big, you know, he's been one of John's mentors his whole life. And he's just, you know, such a good egg and that whole family. And he was really excited to see John find something that he could kind of sink his teeth into. And so, you know, hopefully it works out.
Guys, especially Pete Johnson and other guys like that in that North Shore community sort of were these mentored John.
Oh, 100%.
You know what I mean? And so John gets it. And he's like, hey man, like this is very familiar for me.
Yeah, he does. And, you know, and it's like those guys only have so much bandwidth. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how much attention he gives, but just doing a post like he did and throwing a few waves on the Insta stuff. I mean, the hundred wave Insta followers instantly went up significantly. And you know, the big difference this year is because of COVID, they couldn't do their annual event in San Diego, which was, you know, traditionally it was a 1 day event. Everybody came, you drove all the way to San Diego, as you know, and you caught all 100 waves in a day. Well, this year, because of COVID, they're like, there was danger at first that they couldn't even run it. And they were just like, hey, we don't even know if we're going to be able to do it. Like, and they were like just depressed. And I had been doing these Zoom calls with like John Gother and a couple other guys who were volunteers, who've been volunteers for a long time. And, you know, we're just like, Joe, just open it up. You know, like the whole thing was like, you gotta like let everybody do it on their own terms. And so the general feedback that he got from all those guys who participate, and I'm sure you were probably one of them, was like, hey, let people do it in their own backyard and give them more time. Because 100 waves is a lot to catch in a day. And so that's kind of what they decided. And so this year, the big shift was, hey, it's your 100 wave challenge. You do it. You and your crew can do it at your own break on your dime. Or, you know, I whatever time you want. Here's the window. It's September 15th to November 22nd. This is our window, and so we've got about a month left. Last year they raised $430,000. I think last night they were already at $360,000, and there's more teams signing up right now every day because the word's just starting to get out.
How does somebody sign up if they want to get involved in this? Because this is a great cause.
It's 100wave.org. You go to that site and you can register right there. And when you register, you could register as a participant, or you can register as just sort of like, hey, I just want to be an angel, basically investor and supporter. And you could pick a team to support. So John, for example, has his own team. And right now I think there's just one guy on it, but he's going to be signing more people up. And
what if I want to get on John's team?
You could go join it. That's go join John's team.
Go get on John's team right
now. Yeah, go get on John's team right now.
I'm waiting for him to ask.
Yeah. And the nice thing about John's and Joe is whatever money John's raising, you know, because this is normally the San Diego chapter's fundraiser, but Joe's like, no, anything John and those guys raise is going 50-50 to Hawaii. And,
perfect.
You know what I mean? So it's a great thing for the Hawaii guys. They're really stoked, and it's a great chapter over there. And look, this whole COVID thing's been a wrecking ball for everybody. And you know, these guys have had to shift to a virtual gatherings and that kind of stuff. And so, and it's, you know, as you probably know, I'm not sure if your kids are out of school yet, but anybody who's teaching or putting their kids in school, it's like nobody knew what the heck was going on this year. And they still don't, right? Depending on where you live. And so you can imagine what that's done for these Boys to Men guys as well, because they've had to, you know, there's these schools are so focused on just trying to get their classes up and running and figure out how that's going to work. It's a little bit of an afterthought. And so they've been having to drive a lot of these things themselves and do a lot of the legwork to get these things set up to where they can do the Zoom meetings and stuff like that. Yeah. And this is at a time when these kids need it more than ever. Yeah. They need it more than ever. So I owe you a huge debt of gratitude for introducing me to Joe, because I didn't even know about it. And this has become, for me, it's just like, you know, you and I, when we were in the business, we would get hit up by so many different 501c3s, and there's a lot of great ones out there. The thing I love about this one is it's so easy to see the impact it's making. You can measure it. You could literally measure it.
Yeah.
And you see how effective every dime raised goes, like you're saving kids. And it's so ties into a lot of these social problems that we're having across the country.
Well, you've been a huge part of what Joe and the 100 Wave and the Boys to Men Mentoring Program is doing. So thank you for your hard work there.
Yeah, no problem.
Now I'm going to shift gears real quick.
Sure.
When I spoke to Barton Lynch, I brought up this concept of just hypothetically speaking, of course, because I'm a huge fan of the WSL. I know you're a huge fan of the WSL. Let's say 5 years from now, maybe it's 10 years from now, for whatever reason, the WSL goes away.
Mm-hmm.
It decides it no longer wants to be in the business of guiding pro surfing.
Mm.
And pro surfing is, hypothetically, again, left in sort of a shambles. It's just sort of on the ground. Who's going to pick it up? What does it look like? What does pro surfing look like in 10 years?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't say I'm a huge fan of the WSL. I'm a huge fan of pro surfing. I worked for the WSL, right. And there are a lot of good people there, good eggs, but it's a very freaking dysfunctional place, you know? And people ask me, like, well, what was it like? And I'm like, look, it's not that there's any bad people up there, but it's like, imagine a boat that's taking on water, and then you let five dinghies out to help get the thing to shore, but they're all paddling in different directions. That's essentially the WSL right now. They're all fighting each other. So you have
you were there before Eric Logan.
Doesn't matter. Nothing's changed. Okay. If anything, it's gotten worse. It's just
kind of insight? Like, why do you have this insight?
Just because
gut feeling?
I know people there, and mm-hmm. I've seen what's happened, and I mean, look what's changed since Eric got there. You know what I mean, like. The new world title race thing that they came up with, I think that's a horrible idea. Hate it. You know, that's just me personally.
Right.
I think
this idea of seeding a final event with the number one guy gets more points.
The whole format.
It's very similar to what they do on the PGA Tour.
Yeah, I just don't like it. Yeah. I just think it's too and you and I probably differ.
Aren't you?
I do like change. In fact, I think where you and I probably differ, because I've listened to a couple of your podcasts, and you're one of these people who's like, I only want to see the top 12 guys. And I get it, but like if anything, surfing today is bigger and broader and more exciting than ever. And I love seeing the upstart people go kick the top people's ass. And that's one of the beautiful things about surfing, is like, it's almost like, you know, pool hustler culture. You know, you go tread into Durban and you have to face their best guy.
Yeah.
You should. You should, and you should have to face five of their best guys.
Yeah.
You go to Pipe, you should have to face five of the best guys. You go to Santa Cruz. And so I'm way more of a, I think what needs to happen, and I'm where I've really kind of changed myself, is I used to be a huge fan of Man on Man. As a fan, I can't stand it. It's super boring, and I think it's the biggest problem pro surfing has.
Yeah.
And the four-man priority system has solved a huge piece of the problem there.
Yeah.
That was the reason they went to Man on Man, was to eliminate all the hassling.
Yeah.
The four-man priority thing is a godsend, because, you know, if you're a fan, all these guys catch more waves. And I actually broke it down for Kieran Perreault when I was actually at the WSL, because I was kind of lobbying for, like, hey, we should be doing more four-man and three-man heats.
Yeah.
Because the other problem, when you look at the end of the year and you go look at the stat sheet and you look at how many times Gabe faced John, or how many times, you know, this guy faced that guy, it's freaking like two, one. And it's like a whole year just went by.
Yeah.
I want to see these guys go all the time.
Yeah.
And so when you get these four-man heats and you force these guys at each other, you get way more of those super heats.
Yeah.
And those super heats are exciting. And and you know, people like to shit on those four-man heats that were whatever, like the bonus rounds or whatever. And rightfully so, as far as the elimination process.
It wasn't the number of people in the heats. It was that there was
It was just that there was nobody getting eliminated, right? And so, but the heats themselves were some of the best heats. I remember there was one with like Mick, John and Kelly or something. I forget at Pipe, and it was sick. Yeah. And so I want to see more of that. I want to see all my guys in the water that I want to see, you know, some veterans and some upstarts at the same time.
Would you pay to watch competition online?
No.
Like, say, $60 a year to watch 9 events?
Maybe. I mean, it just depends where the events are and all that kind of stuff. I mean, look, when all the biggest, best sports leagues out there are watchable for free,
yeah.
I think it's really hard to put a lid on the actual competition day. Yeah. I think if you're gonna want to charge a premium, then you got to take me somewhere backstage where that's not. You know, you got to take me somewhere really valuable. Yeah. And frankly, they just haven't shown any capacity to do that.
And there might not be that thing. I want to see
right.
These guys change into their wetsuits.
And the problem is that they can't. You know, the best version of that has always been Peter King's tour notes, you know, during its prime. Yeah. That was sort of as behind the scenes as it gets.
Yeah.
And it was cool. And people love that. And there's various versions of that. You know, a lot of people have tried to knock that off.
Well, Peter has only Peter can do it.
Yeah. Quite frankly. Well, that was
thing. There's probably one or two other guys,
yeah.
But they've got to be guys that are so inside.
Yeah.
That they can kind of call bullshit on.
Totally. Those. Yeah. And they, you know, it takes a lot of nerve to just walk up to one of the best surfers in the world and start mucking around with them.
That's
you know
Peter.
What I mean? And that's PK. And so, you know, he's got the history and the chops. And I think he's one of the sport's great personalities, frankly.
Yeah.
You know, he should be leveraged a lot more.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was pretty involved in getting him involved with WSL when I was there. Cause it was just like, these are the guys we need. We need more of this stuff. And so, I think, but it's really, really tough because surfing, you know, look, as a league, it's not like baseball, football, and all these other things. You know, these guys, when surfers put their jerseys on, that's when we're the least interested in them.
Yeah.
Right. We're more interested in them. You know, they're doing that so they can go take their jersey off and surf everywhere.
Yeah.
You mean like that's why they started this whole thing. Yeah. That was the whole reason they got into contests, was to go
to be able to surf,
to be able to go surf somewhere else, you know? And it was like, it's not like this is not, that was not the dream, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think we're, you know, jockifying the sport has been really, you know, we talked earlier about just the reducibility factor. Mm-hmm. It's just reduced it to this thing that it's not in touch with anything about our culture.
Right.
And so that to me is the big struggle they face. And there's not that many outside of the internal squabbles they have among departments there and where things should go.
That first guy, the WSL guy that was really a bull in a China shop.
Speaker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Call Speaker came and he imprinted this. We're going to be the NFL.
Yeah.
And it's almost as if that culture, they're afraid to change that culture, even though Speaker's, he might be on the board or something, or he might have Dirk's ear. I don't know, but
no, I think he's pretty much gone,
but you know what I mean? It's like they haven't really shed that skin yet. Almost.
It's really just a, dysfunctional situation in that you've got the broadcast people who want to try to, you know, make it go that way. You have, you know, the TV people who want to make these reality shows. You've got the social team who wants to just keep everything on Facebook and whatever. And then you've got the sort of the app / you know, owned and operated part of the equation where it's like, hey, we got nothing if we can't get people and monetize them in our own little playground. And so all these warring factions are at each other's throats, and they're all good people. They're all trying to do their thing. But there's definitely not enough, I would say, surfers in the building, you know?
Yeah.
Certainly not the ones calling the shots. And so they're just going to continue to squabble amongst themselves. That's just what it is. And so it
sounds like Surfer Magazine in 2005.
Well, I mean, I don't know if it was, trust me, I've been in dysfunctional places
a lot with you guys.
Well, I don't. Your only squabble was pretty straightforward. It was like, can I have more money? Like, that's a pretty good. And you know, that was a tough position for me to be in when I was there, because you know, you mentioned earlier, like, what was your worst memory? And I'm like, you know what? The worst thing for me was there was all these. We were in the shift. It's hard to think back now, but we were in the shift from slides to digital.
Yep.
And then a lot of these young photographers who were up and coming were really embracing digital. And a lot of the old guys wanted to hang on to it. And then our budgets were such where it was like, you know, we had to.
It was like the phone call with Bernie Baker.
Well, it's like, hey, you have these legends like Brewers and Devines and Surveys and all these guys. And you're like, hey, look, I have to trim your retainer. Because I got to make room for this new guy who's coming up. This guy's Scott Eichner. He's freaking rad, you know, or something like that. That's not an easy discussion to have. No, and you don't make a lot of friends with those kinds of things. And so, but it's part of the business. Yeah. And you know, when the older guys at that point, you know, they had been on their same migration patterns for the last 20 something years. And they're just like, okay, well, here's who I'm taking to Tabby this year.
Mount Rushmore. It was like, telling Rushmore, you're like, dude, we're putting another head in your place. We're chiseling you off.
Yeah. And it's really hard. And so that's not fun. No. You know, that's the kind of shit that comes with the territory though. And so.
Well, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Back to the pro surfing.
So saying no to Bassey was easy.
I'm just kidding. I was on my own.
I didn't control your budget, though.
At some point, I was on my own program.
Yeah,
I had given up, and I was just going to Indo.
You did a fantastic job. And it's kind of funny because I look at where media is today. I know you want to change the subject, but.
If you're going to talk about me, it's okay.
No, what's interesting is like the surfer chat boards.
Yeah.
You were the one who kind of braved into that little space and would always be kind of telling us what was percolating out of there. Because I wouldn't even bother. Because it was just like, it's such a shitstorm in there, right?
Absolutely.
And you have to be able to just not pay attention to critics or whatever. But, you know, Surfer, that was a huge chunk of our traffic, online traffic, was the chat rooms. Yeah. Because it was something that had a history. And, I mean, we have friends who got married because they met in there and stuff, right? And and what's interesting today is, you know, I look a lot of that community, I feel like just went, jumped over to like Beach Grit. The Beach Grit comment section reminds me a lot of surfer chat rooms.
Yeah.
You mean? And that's where a lot of their traffic on, you know, on social and everything comes from.
To be clear though, those guys did their own thing. They would have been successful without me. I just had to go in there and take their shit.
Right. You know? No. And you braved them and you were good. And it was funny. And I only went in there a couple times to address some things. And what was nice was they like, oh wow, he came in and he addressed it. Like they were kind of stoked, you know, but it was like, it's a fascinating little thing. And it's like, if you look at that right now, our world is being run by the surfer chat room.
Exactly. I mean, I will go to Beach Grit or to Stab or to some of these other ones just to read the comments.
Yeah.
Because there are some very clever,
great, really super clever writers and just nice voices and all that kind of
Carol
stuff.
Carol takes a beating on some of those places, but
yeah, well, everybody does. Well, you can't not take
it. So let's say in 10 years, for whatever reason, well, let me put it in this context. Somebody sent me an email the other day, which I thought was fascinating. He's like, hey, why not have the Australian government own pro surfing? Create a non-profit governmental organization that doesn't necessarily have an ROI attached to it or any spreadsheets, and is just doing it for the good of the sport. And it was argued in this email that, frankly, Australians kind of invented pro surfing in some regards, at least like point systems, the early APSA.
The tour.
Yeah. And of course, as you know, that's a huge sporting culture. Pro surfers in Australia, if you don't know it, they're like professional golfers here in America. Like they're
huge,
celebrities.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was a great take. Why not let Australia own and run professional surfing?
God, would you really want to do that to
yes.
the poor Australian government?
Yes, I would.
Well,
they could have events in Hawaii. They could have an event in Indo. They could have an event in Tahiti, and they could have eight events in Australia.
It's funny. I interviewed Nick on my podcast last year, and we had kind of a similar discussion about, you know, what the state of pro surfing, and I really liked his take. He's like, look, because he and Sean are working on that History of Pro Surfing book. I don't know when it's going to come out. I just think they've been sidelined, but his he's like, look, pro surfing, if you think about it, financially, it's really only made sense for about the first 5 years of its life when the industry brands were supporting it and they were growing and those events were actually profitable for them. You know, the OP Pro for OP, I rode for OP. They made a shitload of that event paid for itself in t-shirt sales alone. Yeah. It paid for itself in t-shirt sales alone. Right.
Barton would say those were horrible years because we surfed in crappy 2 foot waves.
Of course.
Against 150 guys.
Yeah. But the early tour wasn't like the late 70s. It was Burley and Bells and, you know, G Land. Yeah.
Height of.
But all I'm saying is that it made sense in those early years. I'm not talking the 80s. I'm even talking just the very early 80s. You're talking about the late 80s. It's a big difference.
Okay.
Because the early 80s, they were still going to like the Ombali Pro and they had some exotic events. Right. You know what I mean? It didn't turn into the parking lot tour until Ian got there and right. just like, you know, Record Bar Pro and, you know, New Jersey and anything that happened. And I love Ian, but I have no problem telling him that was a disaster. And
he has no
body. Yeah, exactly. It was what it was. You know what I mean? And they were just trying to get things off the ground. And at the time it helped, you know, and it was working for the brands that were sponsoring the tour. Everybody feels like, I think the funny thing where I'm getting at with you is, you're under this thing where you're so steeped in surf culture. You're like, well, pro surfing has to exist. Somebody has to take charge of this thing. Like, we need a central body.
I don't necessarily believe that.
And I just don't think, what is the purpose of pro surfing? You have to ask yourself.
Well, you wrote an article in Surfer Magazine that was pro surfing because of what it did for development of hard good materials, mm-hmm. of the quality of the surfboards that we ride. And you would point to Simon Anderson in the three fin and Mark Richards in the twin fin. And if without pro surfing, these things wouldn't have maybe manifested as quickly as they did.
Right. And
these are your words.
Right. And that all happened 30, almost 40 years ago.
So is it over? Right? Is there no more?
No, my point is, it's like, what is surfing's and pro surfing made a lot of sense then. So my question to you now is, what role... Why do we need it? Like, you tell me. And I'm not saying I'm against it. I'm a huge fan of pro surfing. So I'm a huge fan of pro surfing. I'm not a huge fan of the WSL. Fine. I think their handling of pro surfing is horrible.
Okay.
I'm not a professional
surfer.
Right.
Should it exist?
But if you were, it's kind of like, hey, Bash, should we rewrite the Constitution? You know what I mean? Like, okay, if you're going to start the tour from scratch today, how would you basically embody what surfing culture has evolved into now, to where Kai Lenny, you know what I mean? And
UFC model makes a ton of sense.
I think that's a horrible model.
I look at it from an end user. I'm purely from an end user.
You're talking about head to head, just John versus Gabe.
Yeah,
that bores me to shit.
You don't want to see John versus Gabe and Cam Dewey.
I wouldn't mind, but there's nothing on the line other than like little pride. I want to see guys. I want to know who the best in the world is, period. Like the best guy. The biggest problem I have with pro surfing is there aren't enough guys. You think there's too many? I don't think there is enough. I don't think there's enough young guys getting their shot at the big guys. That's the problem.
I think the UFC model proves that can happen. In fact, if you look at UFC,
yeah, but not really.
They'll take number 99 if he's a branding.
Yeah,
character.
But
if he's a character that's going to make Dana White money and get eyeballs on the sport, he'll take the number 99 guy and put him up against Conor McGregor. And if Conor doesn't do it, they'll all point fingers at Conor and call him a puss.
Right, but I feel like the world champ needs to be decided over a number of events at a number of different venues. Right, surfing is so diverse. You know, frankly,
it doesn't mean we can't have UFC model and have this model.
Yeah, we can have both. But my point is if you're trying to determine who a world champion is, my point is you have to open it up and you have to widen the lens, because right now, like, you look at what guys at Jaws are doing on a yearly basis and how many of those guys are on tour, and the tour guys belong at Jaws. A world title should have to go through Jaws to be called a world champ.
Totally.
You know what I mean? And at the same time, you should have to go through Waco.
I'm okay with that as long as Jaws is on the table.
Yeah. So, you know, whatever. And But and my point is, it's like, okay, cool. So let's widen it, and then you know, let's bring Devin Howard or somebody else in here and go, okay, now are we going to force these guys to ride different equipment for a couple events, and judge them on that too? Because that seems something that might be a little bit more interesting, you know.
Is the mid-length tour not a sarcastic concept?
I think there's something to the fact. I think there's like, look, you talk about surf culture, yeah, and you're a huge fan of culture. Yeah. You know, the pro tour, if the problem here is it's being reduced to these little maneuvers that 99% of kids can do, but it's like, I was so bored last year when the Gold Coast event went to Duramba,
yeah,
and every freaking wave was an air reverse closeout.
Yeah.
Like, it was, I just turned it off. I'm like, I can't even watch this. It's like, yeah, it was boring. And I think surfing is this really beautiful art form that has all these different, you know, ways to apply your brush strokes.
So you
and so yeah, that's the other part of the equation that you kind of need to fit in. And when pro surfing, when we're talking about the heyday of pro surfing with Rabbit and MR and Simon and all that stuff, yeah, look, the whole culture was singularly focused on just getting these shortboards to work, yeah, right? To getting us to this high performance land where we are.
Yeah.
But now it's opened back up again. We're in 20 years into a renaissance, maybe 30, of surfboard.
Want the 7.4 to surf like my 6.2.
Yeah, but there's so many different cool ways to ride a wave.
Yeah,
and so, you know, there's something
you
to be said.
Given me a really specific answer though,
because there is none.
Maybe that's the answer.
That's the answer. There is no way to easily solve who the world's best surfer is. You know what I mean? Like, we're in a city.
Do you think Ido Ferrer is the world's best surfer?
I think he's a good surfer.
Yeah, you don't think he's the best?
I don't. I mean, at certain things, yeah.
You're not convinced he could ride a really good longboard.
I think Italo can ride whatever he wants. He's pretty talented.
Could he surf
a longboard?
Could he surf a longboard?
I don't know, man. I saw, you know, him and Felipe riding freaking kayaks at Tavarua and ripping on them. They were surfing at that, yeah, little wave, you know, in the that little wave in
like where the boats launch.
Yeah, where the boats launch. Yeah. And you know, PK did a little tour notes on it, and they were ripping on these things. So could they? They could ride whatever you give them.
Let me
it would be fun to it would be fun to see.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. I would love to see Italo on a mid ranger and see what he looks like,
and have that result be a part of,
yes,
his world championship tour.
100%.
Yeah,
and I wouldn't even be opposed to putting him on a longboard.
Yeah,
you know, that's part of surf culture. Dictate. Well, the old school ones, like the duct tape. You know what I mean? Like, if you're going to decide a world title, like, blow it up and go, okay, well, what is surfing?
Right.
Surfing is all these things, okay? And you might not say
is
gonna foil.
Is it going to be a guitar playing competition? You have to play a ukulele to be a professional champion?
I don't know, but
that's a lot.
Yeah, but, you know, it's that might be a tiebreaker, you know? Connor Coffin trying to stay in the top 10.
What's that Jack Johnson muddy football or something? What is that? Who can play that song the best?
Who can
that
play Bubble Toes or, yeah,
what's
Mud
that
Football?
Mud Football.
Yeah. Yeah, but yeah, that's pretty classic.
What about the concept of Australia running it? Because we're going to need a guiding hand.
Whatever.
Let me throw some names at you.
Okay.
Bob Hurley.
Uh-huh. What about him?
Is he the guy that runs it? I mean, somebody has to run this.
I wouldn't wish that upon Bob.
Well, I'm not saying it's something he would want to do. I'm just trying to.
I think Bob could. I mean, I think you've got to get a guy like, you know, the Ace Buchans, and some of these guys who've actually shown that they would actually show up to board meetings and put up with people. It's a tough job, dude. It's like,
no, you need almost like an Ian figure that's going to just ram stuff through.
Yeah, you do. And it's, I don't know. I mean, I don't know who that person is. And frankly, you know.
Do you think pro surfing exists in 5 years?
Well, I think
a professional tour.
I don't know if it's going to exist next year.
Right.
I don't know if it exists right now.
Well,
I mean, I mean, look, the brands are, they're just bleeding. Like, you know, Rip Curl got sold. Yeah. They'll probably do Bells for another 1 or 2 years for sure. But, I mean, Rip Curl's whole MO with the WSL was like, look, you guys, I know you want to charge us more every year, but we are never going to pay more than this much for our event, period.
Right.
And they were like flat out, like, yeah, that's not going to happen. And that was Rip Curl, who were sold on the tour, and they helped, yeah, create the tour, and they were like all about the tour. Yeah. They have new owners now. Those new owners are probably looking at the number those guys are throwing out going,
not even.
We'll maybe pay half that. You know what I mean? Yeah. So you got, add that into the equation, add the fact that Quiksilver and Billabong are owned by the same company, and there's not a lot of surf blood in those companies.
Have we seen our last world champion?
Well, if they go to this new world title model, yeah. We've seen our last, in my opinion. Like, look, that era is done. That era that we, you know, the last 40 years of what pro surfing was, and not only that, but the industry, like, whoo, that was a good ride, Bassie. We should be high-fiving because that was cool.
I'm just interested.
And it's like, it's just like, you know, change is constant. And but, you know, well, frankly, it's ready for a refresh.
I agree.
But it's ready for a big reset thing and figure it out. And so I think the next generation, it's their job is to come up and figure out how to create something. So I don't think it's going to be a top-down thing. I think it's going to be an emergent order thing.
Right.
I think you're going to have all these little one-off events, mm-hmm, just like you did in the 70s,
yeah,
that are very...
Somebody goes, let's tie this all together.
Yeah, they just go, let's tie it all together. And hopefully all these events are different types of events. One's basically Joel Tudor's like old-school longboard classic one. One guy's a foil one, whatever. And they tie all these different random events together and decide who the world title is. That's where I think it's going.
That's pretty cool.
You know what I mean? I think that's what's
so
going to happen.
You're telling me that we could
Devin Howard's mid-range.
We could have, you know, a Pipeline Masters with, you know, Kai Salas and Justin Quintal and Kai Lenny and Jay Davies and Gabe Medina.
Mm-hmm.
Those, you know, that.
Why not? Why not?
I'm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
what would happen, right, is, yeah, let's just see what happens.
Yeah.
Let's just see what happens.
I think what's going to happen is it's going to blow up, and then you're just going to have individual, like I said, creative little one-off events. I mean, I always go back to that Rusty C5 challenge and how cool that event was for the time.
Yeah.
And people are going to experiment with new formats. They're going to experiment with, you know, forcing people to ride certain types of equipment. And those to me are interesting, especially when you get all the right people on it. And I think it has to be inclusive. I mean, there's so many great personalities and characters, surfers. There's so many talented surfers now.
Well, let's say there's a Pipeline Masters. Let's just say
this year.
Well, no, let's just say in 2 years there's nothing going on. There's just a bunch of individual events, and one of them is the Pipeline Masters.
Mm.
And you're saying I want to get a bunch of different people involved.
Mm. You know?
Well, the permit's going to be for whatever it is, a week.
Yeah.
You can only run so many heats.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? Maybe Marty Thomas runs it. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how's Justin Quintal on a longboard going to knock down the door to get into that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's got to be probably each event has to have its own sort of qualifying metric to get in, you know? And so to be a world champ, you have to qualify on all of those metrics. And, you know, that means it's a taller order. It shouldn't be easy. Well, it shouldn't be easy. You're going to be a world champ. You're going to represent everything surfing represents. Man, you better be well-rounded. You know what I mean? And, you know, but I honestly don't know. You know, when surfers become hyper-focused on it, and you look at all the world champs, like the great ones, like the Kellys and the Mix, and they talk about what effort went into it to be there. And even Barton, during your awesome interview, by the way, last week, that was, if you haven't heard Bassie's interview with Barton Lynch, please go stop this one immediately and go listen. But, you know, you kind of have to become a dick,
yeah,
to go win a title.
Yeah.
You have to get in this mode of like, just, I don't see anybody except for myself, and it's a very selfish pursuit, and blah, 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 blah. So a lot of that is sort of antithetical to just what surfing
hanging
is.
Out at San Antonio.
Yeah, it's just, you know, yeah, you have that, you can only keep that mindset so long, yeah, before you have to kind of escape and relieve some pressure. And so, you know, that, I guess the question there is like, maybe there shouldn't ever be any more than 8 events or 10 events or something, you know, I don't know, or even 6.
You definitely don't know. You haven't heard of right of you.
I
love this global view that you have, but we certainly haven't solved any problems on who's going to pick it up, what it's going to look
no,
like.
No, I don't think you and I are going to have, I think it's the next generation's problem to solve.
Yeah.
I think it's the kids who are 17, 18, 19 right now.
Yeah.
I think it's their problem to solve. And like, they're going to have to come up with their own rabbits and Sean's and MRs and Simons to figure this out.
It's market driven. Like if those 17 and 18 year olds right now or 16 year olds right now, mm-hmm. like, how do I be as pro surfer?
Yeah.
And it's market driven. And the mm-hmm. market is basically flourishing with just be an influencer on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens. Mm-hmm. It's kind of already happened.
Yeah, no, I mean, the whole definition of pro surfer has been completely blown up. And it's like, now it's Mason Ho and Jamie O'Brien and Ben Gravy
and Kyle Lenny.
Kyle Lenny. And and more power to those guys. Like, yeah. I think that's wonderful.
Jonathan Wayne Freeman, frankly.
Yeah, Jonathan Wayne Freeman is a pro surfer.
Exactly. He's like top 20.
For sure. For sure. 100%.
I love that.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. Like, it's personality driven. And so that, to me, it's like, it's great because all these guys are who they are. Mason Ho is who he is. He's being authentic.
Absolutely.
You mean? And the kids today, you know, they smell authenticity a mile away.
Yeah.
And if somebody, they just feel it's like he's just going through the motions, they're not interested.
Yeah.
You know, they know what was bought and paid for.
Who's the number one surfer in the world? You maybe mentioned him based on this sort of format or this
Well, I just think I still think the most interesting surfer in the world. Well, it's kind of changed of late because I think the last time you and I talked was like a year and a half ago. But right now, the two most fascinating characters to me are Kai and Mason Ho.
Yeah.
Those two, I just love everything they do. I think they're having fun. I think they're pushing the limits.
Yeah.
Is
there anyone close to them regarding these categories that you just mentioned?
Fun,
pushing the limits, authentic, and getting their message out there.
I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of, like, there's a great little sort of ride everything crew. We talked about Corey Colapinto. Corey Colapinto is one of my favorite surfers in the world.
Yeah.
And
Cuca Pinto
is his Instagram. Yeah. And because he rides everything. Yeah. And rides it all well.
Yeah.
I don't know how he would do in big waves. I've never seen him in big waves. But
again, I don't think that matters. This conversation is about what pro surfing is really become.
But I think what's cool about now, and you know, I know you and I, like, we miss the magazines and stuff like that, but it's like you find people like that and you follow them and you curate what you want this experience to be. And there are a lot of cool, interesting characters out there.
Do you follow Dane's wife?
Yeah, she's awesome.
She's awesome.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite Instagrams.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Napkin Apocalypse.
Yeah, yeah. She's hilarious.
Is she one of the top 20 pro surfers?
I don't know. I mean, if you want to loosen it that much, maybe. But does she surf?
No.
I don't think she surfs. So, yeah, I wouldn't say so.
We're going too far.
Yeah, I think you're stretching it. Right. But, you know, I think that model isn't going away. And they're a huge threat. They are a huge threat to the sport that you and I, you know, kind of would like to see still some semblance of it out there.
Yeah. We're romanticizing it perhaps.
I feel like it's been stagnant for a while. The sport. I feel like it's been stuck in this sort of archaic
thing. The WSL would argue, and I would argue that the Billabong Pro the Pipeline Masters, excuse me, I guess it was a Billabong Pro Pipeline Masters, in 2019 was incredible. We had everything set up perfectly so that we had it kind of going down to the wire between everybody, you know, Gabe. And the three or four people that were in the running, I think Kolohe was in the running.
Mm.
That was very exciting. If you follow pro surfing, if you're a fan of pro surfing, doesn't get, you know, I mean, it might have gotten that good in 2006 when Kelly and
there's a few years. Like, I look back on a couple, I was thinking about it. I asked the question on my little Instagram handle the other day, like, what was peak Slater? You know, what was Kelly Slater's best moment in pro surfing?
To me, that was Chopu letting go, being comboed by Bruce Irons. And getting two tens and then drinking a beer in the tube on his way out.
Yeah.
This is a letting go moment, right? That might be Slater's best moment.
I thought that was one. I thought the other one, which was very meaningful in a way was in 2013 when he came from behind to beat John at Pipe. And, you know, John was like ready to freaking just grab the torch, wanted to take it from him. Kelly's just trying to extend his life on the tour, show he still got it. It was kind of like that, what's that Kevin Costner baseball movie, For the Love of the Game kind of thing. Right. You know, he's just trying to like one more time, you know, just do it for the old guy. And, you know, John's up in front of the heat with like 2 8s or 9s or something. Kelly comes back to win it. And John was just shattered, like shattered, you know, and he still hasn't won a Pipe Masters, right? Ooh. So it's like, that's one of those things where it's like, that win to me for Kelly was, it's got to be one of his most meaningful. Because it's all the student master thing. It's the old guy, young guy. It's the handing off the torch. No, I'm not ready to give it to you yet. Those moments, I think, are where there's all these other dynamics at play. Those are the ones that, and when I was at WSL, the thing I really enjoyed exploring was those guys who were just on the bubble, like the Jads and Andres and them. Like I really enjoyed being able to do a profile on him. We did like a 10-minute little mini doc on Jadson, and I feel like it had a huge impact on the way people perceive him. Anybody who saw it, they came away just
we're
going,
all fans now.
We're like, dude, this is my guy, you know? And there's so many of those blue collar guys who, and through history, they've been there, you know, who just slug it out, and they're all great surfers. And I have so much respect. Like I know the pundits like to just rail on the guys in the back 30, but you don't get to that level without being a phenomenal surfer. Like they're all really good surfers.
I'm never doubting their talent. I'm always doubting what's between their ears.
Yeah. And that's fair enough. But I think, you know, what the job of, you know, what the WSL needs to do is if they're going to do anything to keep people interested, they have to tell personal stories of who these guys are. Show what is their journey. Who are they? Because you care. You're way more emotionally attached. We actually did the data on the Jadson thing too. Yeah. After that Jadson profile came out, if you looked at what the viewership on his heats was after that, it was way higher. Like, because, you know, you see the dropout rates. We could watch that.
I would even suggest
actual viewership.
It needs to be authentic personal stories. Which
exactly.
Is what we did, because they put some stuff out there, but you just feel like their handlers have too much of a say.
Well, if it's sponsored, it's super fluffy.
Yeah.
It's got to be editorial. You know what I mean? And that was the thing. None of those ones that we worked on when I was there were sponsored. It was just like, it was all real.
Yeah.
And so those were fun to do. And I wish, you know, we could be doing more of those because that's what we need to see. And there's so many of those stories to tell.
Well, that's what People Who Surf is all about.
Yeah.
Your podcast.
Yeah.
We're going to end it there, Chris. We said a lot.
I know. We always just like, we always have fun.
And again, your podcast is People Who Surf and your Instagram is People Who Surf and people should go check that out.
Yeah. I think it's People Who Surf Shows, the Instagram.
Okay.
Check it out. If you're interested in the podcast, I don't come out with them as frequently as you, although you took a little break too, but I took a pretty big break, but we're back. I just did Sean Thompson actually, a couple weeks ago.
Oh, cool.
And then, that was a really interesting one. And then the next one is actually, I went up and just did a visit with Chris Malloy on his ranch in Los Alamos.
Oh, cool.
And so, you know, he's kind of been in this self-induced exile for a while, and I hadn't, you know, heard from him, so it was so fun to go catch up with him and see what his whole deal is. And actually went back up and talked to Keith and Dan too, and cool, just to get their input. So
sounds like a good one.
That's one's up. Yeah, that'll be up maybe by the time this thing comes out. It'll be on the verge. But thanks for having me, dude.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, always fun catching up with Bassie.
All right, well, until next time, thank you, Chris.
Thank you, bud.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, Always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry. There's rich folks eating from a fancy dining car. They're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars. Well, I know I had it coming. I know I can't be free. But those people keep a moving, and that's what tortures me. Freed me from this prison. If that railroad train was mine, I bet I'd move it on a little farther down the line. Far from Folsom Prison, that's where I want to stay. And I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away.